Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the Voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with the program that helps you learn and improve your American English. We begin today with news from Syria. Some people fear that violence there may spread north into Turkey. Details are just moments away. Then we will visit the city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to meet a businessman who is making money by being a good neighbor and keeping his business green. Exactly what does that mean? Stay with us and find out. Let's get started with As It Is from VOA. Here is part one. The Sunni militant group ISIL has increased attacks in Syria near the border with Turkey. A growing number of Turks fear the violence could spread to their country. Earlier this month, a mosque in Istanbul was burned down. The building belonged to Turkey's Shiite Muslim minority. Officials blame the attack on ISIL. As we hear from Mario Ritter, more such attacks could threaten Turkey's social mix.
The city of Istanbul is home to large numbers of followers of both Sunni Islam and Shiite Islam, or Jafari Islam, as it is known in Turkey. But tensions between the two sides have been rising following the burning of Istanbul's Jafari Muhammadiya Mosque. Turkey's neighbors, Iraq and Syria, have seen growing religious unrest between Sunnis and Shiites. The violence has mainly been blamed on the rise of ISIL. The Sunni group, formerly known as the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Now the group simply calls itself the Islamic State. It considers Shiites heretics, individuals who dispute accepted religious beliefs. Sinan Ulgen is with the Carnegie Europe Institute in Brussels. He says fears are growing that ISIL's war is coming to Turkey.
There are allegations that some members of a network that claim to be close to ISIS have engineered this. Some of these militant groups have been able to establish their networks within Turkey over the years, during the time that the Turkish government turned a blind eye to many of these opposition groups. It just shows that Turkey is not going to be safe from all the instability from Syria.
Turkey's ruling Islamist-based AK Party is one of the main supporters of the rebels fighting the Syrian government. The attack on the mosque in Istanbul has not been the only incident. The city's Shiites say they have been the target of increasing sectarian violence. Politics could also be partly to blame for the rising tensions. Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a candidate for president in elections this month. He is seeking support among his largely conservative Sunni religious base. Critics have accused him of increasingly using language aimed at Shiites. He also has resisted calls to condemn the mosque attack. Mehmet Gomez is head of the Diyanet, the agency that administers the Islamic religion in Turkey. He did visit the mosque in an attempt to bridge differences. Observers say such actions could ease rising tensions and concerns over the growing danger of militant groups like ISIL. However, ISIL flags and signs are increasingly seen at protests organized by Islamic groups. This suggests that at least some Sunnis in Turkey have sympathy for the group. Experts warn that ISIL's increasing presence is likely to put pressure on Turkey's diverse society. I'm Mario Ritter.
You are listening to As It Is from VOA Washington. Gabrielle Manduhano operates a cleaning service called Wash Cycle Laundry. He opened the business 4 years ago in the American city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. At the time, Mr. Manduhano had three goals: earning a profit, developing community, and staying green, not harming the environment. Now, he has not only met those goals, but his business is expanding. Bob Doty tells us more.
It is not hard to find people working for Wash Cycle Laundry. They wear bright orange t-shirts and ride bicycles with big orange trailers on the streets of Washington, D.C. The cyclists and their vehicles pick up dirty laundry and take clean clothing to customers, users of the service. That separates Wash Cycle Laundry from other businesses. But that is not the only difference. The clothing and linens are cleaned with locally produced and environmentally friendly cleaning products. Gabrielle Manduhano wanted Wash Cycle Laundry to go green, using products considered safe for the environment. But he also wanted his company to stay competitive.
I think a lot of times when people hear environmentally friendly, they automatically think more expensive. But laundry is a really neat industry where it's cheaper to save water and energy than it is to waste it.
He notes that it costs less to use the equipment of other companies.
We've done millions of pounds of laundry, but we actually don't own a single washing machine ourselves. We're not bringing anything new to the market. What we've done differently is, rather than building one gigantic plant, off in an industrial park somewhere that's, 40 or 50 miles away from the city, we've established ourselves in a lot of micro plants where we're, three and four blocks away from our clients. We always find laundries that are underutilized, and then we make an agreement with the ownership of that laundry to use it during their downtimes.
Gabrielle Manduhano says Washington seemed like a good place to set up his cleaning service.
There's a lot of people who don't have the time but do have a little bit of income that they can use to afford our service.
Mr. Manduhano once worked with community development nonprofit groups. He says that experience continues to influence his business decisions.
About half of our employees are from what we call a vulnerable adult population. That means they could have been chronically unemployed, they could be coming off of a public benefits program. A number are in recovery from substance use, some have a history of incarceration.
Shawnice Fox is one of the company's newest employees.
I thought I wasn't going to be able to continue working here because of my own personal problems, but they helped me out and I'm still here, so, and everything is going great now. I'm trying to just sustain one job and be able to be there for, years in advance in a company instead of keep hopping from job to job.
Jim Starn is a satisfied customer of Wash Cycle Laundry. He owns a massage therapy business. He likes the company's effort to help those in need and to go green.
It's easy. I don't have to worry about the truck coming by and blocking traffic and people being irritated. And I love the fact that they're just not using all that gasoline. Because we're a massage studio, people come to us for natural wellness and alternatives. So the fact that we don't have to worry about the chemicals and the bleach and all the things that can be in the laundry, and the laundry comes back spotless, is just terrific.
Chris Walk works as a cyclist for Wash Cycle Laundry. He explains why he likes his job.
I get to move around, be active, be out in the sun. My body is engaged, but my mind is free, which I really appreciate.
That is just what Gabrielle Manduhano hoped for when he launched the business.
My family was probably a little bit concerned when I told them I was quitting my job to start a laundry business. This isn't the most glamorous profession. I mean, it's not quite like, you know, going to a dinner or a cocktail party and saying, oh, I'm a doctor, or I'm a lawyer, or I'm a banker. You know, I think as the business has grown, people have started to see the vision and what we've been able to accomplish and where we might go.
He plans to expand Wash Cycle Laundry to other American cities and, he hopes, around the world. I'm Bob Doty.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is VOA.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Education Report. A neighborhood school in New York City produces champions at the game of chess. Students at Brooklyn's Intermediate School 318 have won 32 titles or championships in competitive play of the ancient game. The preteens and young teens have even defeated older students. John Galvin is an assistant leader and the chess program chief at the school. He says most of the young people come from homes where conditions make it hard to succeed. Mr. Galvin says they need more help to get a good start in life.
So we think our program really teaches kids that they can be great at something. So when our kids from Williamsburg, Brooklyn go around and beat all the best private schools in the country, beat the best high schools in the country, we think that sends a powerful message.
80 students are taking part in the chess team during the school year. Chess Summer School is open to 40 young people. They learn chess skills like planning and decision making. Samantha Dong says the game calls for imagination.
In reading, you have to imagine the story or what's going on. But in chess, you also have to see what is your opponent's doing and what are they threatening.
Another student says, chess helps with all kinds of schoolwork, and it is fun. The school program has gained worldwide fame. In 2012, Norwegian chess grandmaster Magnus Carlsen visited the school to congratulate the national champions. A full-length film released at that time tells the story of 5 team members. The movie Brooklyn Castle also shows the difficulties they face in their personal lives. 70% of the families in the school's neighborhood are very poor. But the school's principal, Eric Windley, says the importance of chess is that it gives every student a chance.
Anybody can play chess, whether you're shy, whether you're outgoing, whether you have a lot of friends, you don't have a lot of friends. Chess is a game that anybody can play. And once they play it, they like it.
Pobo Efikoro is a former national chess champion and a graduate of the school's chess program. He is helping the summer school students improve their chess game. He says life is a game of chess. He says players have to make the right moves.
You have to be able to, when you're confronted with a situation, you have to be able to sit back, analyze the situation before you go on with it, before you make a decision and proceed with that decision.
Pobo Efikoro says he will always be able to take those skills away from the game. He says he will be able to use them in his life every day. 98% of Intermediate School 318 students graduate from high school. Most go on to attend college or university. And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. I'm Jerry Watson.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the 1820s, in the state of New York, a man named Joseph Smith started the Mormon religion. Smith based it on what he said were God's words to the ancient people of America. Many people became members of the new church. Others, however, laughed at some of the beliefs of the Mormons. This led to trouble. Smith had to move his people many times. For a while, they settled in the state of Illinois, in a town they built and called Nauvoo. The church split when Joseph Smith said that Mormons could have more than one wife. The split led to violence and public opposition to the Mormons. Smith was arrested and put in jail. A mob attacked the jail and killed Smith and his brother. The governor of Illinois ordered the Mormons to leave the state. This week on our series, Sarah Long and Richard Rail discuss relations between the Mormons and the federal government.
Brigham Young became the new leader of the Mormons. He told his people that he had seen their new home in a dream. He said it was a wide, beautiful valley in the west. He said he would recognize it when he saw it. The Mormons left Illinois in the spring of 1846. There were more than 15,000 people and many wagons and farm animals. The trip west was hard. Many of the people died. After months of slow travel, they stopped to make their winter camp.
Explorers visited the camp. They told Brigham Young about a great salt lake in a wide valley on the western side of the Rocky Mountains. From the way they described it, Young believed it was the valley of his dream. He started to move his people toward the Great Salt Lake as soon as the winter snows melted. They arrived in the summer of 1847. Brigham Young looked out over the valley. "This," he said, "is the right place."
The Mormons wasted no time. 2 hours after arriving, they began to prepare the ground for planting. The lake water was too salty to use, so they built a system of canals to bring water down from the mountains. The first few years were difficult. Cold weather and insects destroyed their crops. Yet the Mormons continued to work hard to make their settlement a success. They refused to think of leaving.
At first, the Mormons were ruled only by the laws of their church and by their leader. Then gold was discovered in California. Many non-Mormons passed through the Salt Lake area on their way to the gold fields. Some of them stayed. It soon became clear that new laws were needed to govern the growing population. The Mormons asked Congress to approve a territorial government for their land. They called the land Deseret. That was a Mormon word meaning honeybee. The Mormons claimed a large area. It stretched from the mountains of Colorado west to the mountains of California, from Arizona north to Oregon.
Congress rejected the large claim of Deseret and made it a much smaller territory. It also refused to accept the name Deseret. Instead, Congress called it Utah, after the Ute tribe of Native American Indians that lived there. As a compromise, Brigham Young was named governor of the new Utah Territory. Most of the new territorial officials were Mormons, too. Four were not Mormon.
Governing the territory would not be easy. There were disputes during the administrations of several American presidents. As a result of one dispute, the four non-Mormon officials returned to Washington. The Mormons then formed their own territorial government with a legislature and courts. Other federal officials were sent to Utah. Some of them were not prepared for the job. Usually, they did not stay long.
Some of the officials made many charges against Brigham Young and other Mormon leaders. They said Mormons refused to recognize the power of the federal government. They said Mormons put the words of Young above the laws of Congress. They said the church had a secret organization to take the lives and property of those who questioned the power of the church. There were charges that Mormons had burned the papers of the Supreme Court of the territory, and there were charges that Mormons were responsible for Indian attacks on some officials. President Franklin Pierce decided he should make someone else governor of Utah. The man he chose, however, did not want the job. Instead, he urged the president to let Brigham Young remain. President Pierce agreed.
Relations between the Mormons and the government did not improve in the next 3 years. Territorial officials resigned. They charged that the Mormons were in open rebellion against the federal government. The next president, James Buchanan, dismissed Brigham Young as governor. He ordered more than 1,000 soldiers to go to Utah to put down the rebellion. He also sent a new governor, Alfred Cumming, with the soldiers. The Mormons prepared to fight. A small group of Mormon men attacked and destroyed the army's supply wagons. They forced the soldiers to stop for the winter before reaching the Salt Lake Valley. The soldiers could do nothing until spring.
In Washington, efforts were made to settle the dispute. A man named Thomas Kane asked President Buchanan to let him go to Utah. Kane was an old friend of the president. He also was a friend of the Mormons. He had spent much time with them during their long trip to Utah 10 years earlier. Kane feared what might happen to his Mormon friends if fighting started. He told President Buchanan that he did not want a job or money. He only wanted a chance to be useful. The president agreed to let him try to settle the dispute.
Thomas Kane arrived in Salt Lake City, the territorial capital, early in 1858. He found that the Mormons had decided not to fight. Instead, they were preparing to search for a new home. They talked of moving to Mexico, or perhaps to an island in the South Pacific. Kane talked with Brigham Young. Then he went to the army camp to talk with Governor Cumming. The governor agreed to go to Salt Lake City with Kane. The two men went alone, without any soldiers.
The Mormons welcomed Cumming, but continued their preparations to leave. Cumming called a public meeting. He said he was in Utah to represent the federal government. He said he was there to make sure the people of the territory obeyed the Constitution and the laws of the United States. He said he would not use military force until every other way had failed. Above all, said Cumming, he would not interfere with the Mormon religion. He urged the Mormons not to leave the land they had worked so hard to build. Brigham Young agreed to stay.
Governor Cumming returned to the army camp. He told the commander that the Mormons had accepted him. He said military force would not be needed. A few days later, two representatives of President Buchanan arrived. They brought news that the president would not act against Mormons who accepted the rule of the United States government. Brigham Young and the other Mormon leaders made a statement. They said they wished to live in peace under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. The dispute was over. Brigham Young continued to lead the Mormon Church, but the governor ruled the territorial government. The two jobs were separate and would remain that way.
Congressional elections were held in the United States in 1858. One political race created national interest. It was for one of the two Senate seats representing the state of Illinois. The candidate of the Democratic Party was Stephen Douglas. He was running for re-election. His opponent was a lawyer and a member of the Republican Party. His name was Abraham Lincoln. That will be our story next time.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Sarah Long and Richard Rail. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.